listening to 88.9 FM, KUCI Irvine. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views of KUCI or the University of California, Irvine.
That was a lot of introduction. Good morning and welcome to this July 24th, 2019 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org. We are always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes under Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Facebook, also Writers on Writing, KUCI FM. Barbara's website is penonfire.com. My website is mariestone2rs.com. I'm your host, Marie Stone, and I am doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft. I'm here now with Taffy Brodesser-Ackner, and in the second half, Kathleen Alcott will be here talking about her latest novel, America Was Hard to Find. Taffy Brodesser-Ackner is an American journalist. She has worked freelance and as a contributor for GQ and the New York Times, where she is now a staff writer. Her profiles of celebrities have won her the New York Press Club Award and Mirror Award. She's known for her profiles of Gwyneth Paltrow, Don Lemon, Nicki Minaj, Paula Deen. The list goes way, way on. And if that wasn't enough, she's now turned some of her attention to fiction. Fleischman is in Trouble is her first novel. I have confirmed it is not her last novel. It's published by Penguin, and we are going to talk about all of it this morning. Taffy, welcome.
Thank you. It's Random House. Okay. So who can keep track anymore?
Oh, I don't even know where I got that from. Okay. Thank you.
I don't even, it's a difficult good, landscape
good,
to navigate.
Good catch.
Days. They're
good
all
catch.
In the same building.
There you go. Well, it's time for more coffee. All right. So, so I hear this novel began in a Pan Quotidian after GQ rejected the pitch as an article. So, maybe we set the stage. You talk about the origins of Fleischman is in Trouble and kind of take us into Toby and Rachel's crumbling world.
Sure. When I turned 40, a lot of my friends started coming to me and telling me that they were getting divorced. And, you know, I'm not getting divorced. I, in fact, just hit the year in my marriage where my parents didn't reach, right? Like, I'm in this kind of zone of unknown because my parents divorced by the time they were married for 13 years. But friends around me were getting divorced, and I was at their weddings. And I remember that I was exactly as happy on my wedding day as they were on theirs. And it was pretty shocking to me to watch these marriages fall apart, to have seen people recently and not realize that they were in trouble. What struck me most about it was that they by the time they told me that they were getting divorced, they had made peace with it, they were fine, and they'd already started dating, or at least they had downloaded these amazing dating apps to their phone, and they would show me their phones, and I could not believe what was going on with them. They were my age. They were people that long ago we were dating at the same time. It was a struggle for all of us, and now it seemed so easy and available, and they were all so excited about it. And I remember having this very specific feeling every time a friend of mine spoke about that, which was that the feeling was, oh, you're young again. I had gotten to the point where I thought I was now old and it was time to mellow out. And I was 40. This is it. This is life. But when I saw them, I realized they still had so much life left. They were young, and it started, I started thinking of myself differently, and I loved thinking about it. And I called up my GQ editor, like you said, and I asked him if I could write a story about this. And he said, you don't always seem out of touch, but in this moment you do. Every GQ reader has been on dating apps since they started dating. They wouldn't even understand what you were talking about. But you should write this for somewhere else, and I would love to read it because I, too, am of a certain age and would like to make sense of it. I thought about writing it for the New York Times, where I also had a contract, and I might have, but I was walking down the street, and again, I was so lit up over this material that I just pulled over into a Pan Quotidian. I wish it were kind of a better story with a more interesting place, but I pulled over into it, and I wrote the first 10 pages in like a minute. And I was off and running.
What did that look like? Like, what did you start with? You obviously started with the idea, but you must have started out. What did you start out with? The characters, or kind of tell me about those first 10 pages, and if they stayed, or if you know they were like a vestigial limb that kind of you could see them there, but they weren't there anymore.
They are exactly what you read in the book. In fact, the first 10 pages and the last 20 pages are the things I wrote first. And didn't change at all, except with one exception, that the book at first was all third person, including the narrator. The narrator was a character in the book. Mm. And my editor felt like that wasn't explicit enough, and that wasn't, the thing I was trying to do wasn't working. But I guess I resisted it, because in the magazine profiles I write, I'm very often a first-person character, uh-huh. You know, a first-person nonfiction character. And I wanted the fiction to be a little bit different. But the fiction got much better when my editor would ask me, why do you want it to be different? Like, this thing works for you. This is how you write. This is, you know, this is how you do it. In fact, a very, very close friend who helped me through a couple of drafts said to me, you know, he used to be a magazine editor of mine as well, and he said to me, you know, if you were a man, you would not be trying to be different in any form of your writing. You would recognize that you had success in this, and you can also have success in this just by being yourself, that you are not at a stage in your writing life that you have to try on new things to see how they work. So once I made the novel closer to what I do with nonfiction, it opened up and became a lot livelier. But I'm a very fast writer. It just came out of me that way. The rest didn't. The rest, a lot of revisions. But I knew immediately that I wanted to set this in the world that I'm from. I wanted to set this among the people who are like me, who are just now discovering themselves as newly interesting, newly sexually attractive, newly free. And I could only do that with the kinds of characters that are like the people that I know. I'm from a Jewish community. I was raised in a very religious household, but I went to more modern schools. And, you know, the short Jewish doctor, the short Upper East Side Jewish doctor is the cliche of my life. But that's what I wanted. I wanted somebody who had what he felt was a legitimate reason to feel bad about himself in his earlier life, and who could now realize that everything he thought about himself may not have been true, which is supposed to tip you off to the nature of this book, that everything you think you know for sure is not necessarily true.
Right, right. I love how you once said you first thought it was a dating book, and then you realized it was a marriage book, and then you realized it was a divorce book, and then you wrote it, then you could finish it.
Right.
And I love that process of discovery of the writer herself being surprised by where the book takes her, as opposed to, I'm going to sit down and write about dating apps, and, you know, that it has to be a process of discovery as much for you as it does for the reader, right?
Right, that you are just, you're on fire about something, and you don't necessarily know why yet. You just know it's interesting. You have this moment that you have to have, summon a lot of confidence to pay attention to this moment of, I'm so interested in this. Maybe other people will be interested in it too. Like that's the moment that is very, very important. And by the way, the discovery doesn't really end. I thought it was about dating, then I thought it was about marriage, then I thought it was about divorce. And then watching people, you know, it's been out for a month, and I've listened to a lot of podcast conversations about it. I saw, I had a reading last night where people, most of the people in the audience had read the book. It was at a bookstore. I'm
so
sorry
great.
For the bookstore. Most of the people owned the book, and they just wanted to talk about it. A writer that I really admire named Joe Nocera said on Twitter that people think that this is a divorce book, but it's not. It's a marriage book. Mm. And the minute he said that, I was like, of course. Mm. It's a marriage mm-hmm. book. Mm-hmm. And then someone else corrected him. I wish I should look up who it is, and said, it's not a book about marriage or divorce. It's a book about middle-aged malaise.
And I was like, that's
yes.
true.
Yeah, and had never occurred to me, but why not? I just told you the entire introduction of me coming to understand these people and how it ends up with me saying, you're not, I thought I was old, but now I see that I'm still pretty young.
Yeah, right.
And I guess, you know, the book isn't mine anymore. It belongs to everyone else. And watching them interpret it, they're all right.
I love that you said that, because I do always think it's very interesting that once the book leaves your hands, the editor's hands, it does. It has this whole life out there on its own that sometimes the writer had never intended. And then you have all these interesting conversations with people, and you learn more about your book than you knew when, you know, in the 10 years or, you know.
Right. I'm very lucky that I have a lot of practice with, you know, keeping my mouth shut while I watch people either online, on the radio, on podcasts, discuss my work. I, you know, I've written a few prominent stories for the Times. A lot of people read the Times, and there's nothing for you to really add. Like I learned a long time ago that those discussions are not for me. Nobody's even interested in me correcting the, you thought it was that, mm-hmm. but it's really that. It's not mine anymore. And I'm very lucky that I had that experience, because I think the thrust of all these people discussing my book in front of me might make me feel either breathless or defensive, or that I wanted to explain things to them. And I know, even though I want to, I know not to. And because I know not to, I actually am open up to this very interesting world of understanding how my work is received and what people have taken from it and what it means to them.
Does that impact the way you approach writing when you're doing it, or is that only an after-the-fact thing? I'm wondering if your knowledge now that the work is no longer yours makes you, when you're working on it, less, like it's less precious, or it's less so personal that it's murky in some way. I don't know if you know what I'm trying to get at.
I think I know what you mean. And what I'll say about it is this, that I don't ever think about that when I'm writing. I'm like everybody else at their job, which is I have one person I report to, and I want him to I write just for him. Mm-hmm. In every place, when I was at both GQ and the New York Times on contract, the stories were different, not because of the magazines, but because of the editors and because what I knew their taste was. Mm. If I think about anything beyond just my editor reading it, I will crumble. Like, could you imagine writing a book like this, knowing your mother will one day read it, knowing your children will one day have access to it, knowing that people, like your rabbi, people you went to school with, I can't keep those people in my head. Yeah. So it's to me, and also for self-preservation, for me, I have to keep it as something I did for my editor, and if he thinks it's a success, or she thinks it's a success, because I have two editors here at the Times, if they think it's a success, then it was a success to me. I do pay attention. I'm not someone who doesn't read reviews, and I do pay attention to what people think about a book, because we're in heady times. Like I don't know what I don't know, and sometimes there are real lessons to be learned from listening to how people received your work. And if that, like, now I know even from the novel, oh, if that wasn't my intention, that's a thing I should work on. That, you know, that people think this about a story, or think people think that, or they interpreted that. I wouldn't ever say they misinterpreted it. I would say that I didn't make my intentions clear enough, and I think you can always get better at that. So I don't have a lot. I understand the instinct to never read reviews, to just keep yourself confined to the work, but I also think that many riches await you if you can figure out a way to read it, understand it without letting it in. I say that as someone who's had good reviews for the most part, so right. I understand what I'm asking, but I also think we're not writing inside a cave. It matters to us what people think of our work.
Right. I think it's interesting, and you made the observation that the jump from journalism to fiction is that you're no longer able to observe someone, that you have to make all of this up whole cloth, and you don't have somebody, you know, you don't have somebody sitting before you, you know, playing with their straw or something that you can draw from. And I was kind of wondering if you have tips and tricks for how you did that, if you kept somebody else in your head as you were doing this and kind of drew from them, or what you did to jog your imagination.
So I was I had these blank slates. I had these faceless people, but people are all about their face, right?
Right.
So I had these sketches, and I didn't have anything specific, and I couldn't figure out a way to graft it on to anyone I knew, for the simple reason that always feels like revenge writing. And I think revenge writing is always bad writing. I interviewed Jonathan Franzen a few years ago for the magazine, and he told me that the reason it was so hard to write Freedom, why it took so long, was because at first he was writing all of these He had real issues with the, you know, how the press tour went for the corrections, you know, the Oprah thing and all of that. Mm-hmm. And he was very angry, and he and that anger was coming through in his work. It just wasn't making for what he thought was very good writing. I'm sure it was great writing because he's Jonathan Franzen. And I hope I'm remembering that story correctly. I hate to quote people without consulting my notes, but I think about that, and I don't want to put anyone real in there. And also, if I put someone real in there, I don't really know it's too dangerous. I'm a journalist. I will stick too closely to the material, and that is a dangerous thing for me, because those are people I know, and then it will be true.
Right.
What I did instead was remember this, that a thing that I know I'm good at is I get very little time with a celebrity, and I have to take what they've said and I have to extrapolate it, and I have to extrapolate feelings that came from the thing that they told me. Oh, I was rejected. That must feel bad. I got married. That must have been a happy day. Those kinds of things. That's a very basic version of what I'm talking about. But I realize that if I create a sketch of these people, that what I can do is create in them perfect cauldrons of tension, and then extrapolate. A thing I've learned over the years, which I didn't know when I was in film school and trying to write screenplays, and I was trying to create these flawed heroes who are also really good guys, or these, you know, anxious women who are bumbling heroines, right? Those were the category of person you created in my film school, in the screenwriting program. Mm-hmm. What I learned over all of these years of writing journalism is that people will be so happy if you give them something complicated, because the truth is very complicated. People contain all of these different characteristics that are at odds with their other characteristics. Everyone is very complex. So if you know about somebody that they are cheap, they are also generous. If you know about somebody that they are loving, they are also full of venom. And once you take a person and you pick a trait for him or her, the opposing trait is probably the inner turmoil of their lives.
Hmm.
And after that, if you could create that, then all you have to do is give one stimulus at the beginning of the story and let them just have chain reaction after chain reaction. The things I wasn't good at, that I had to work very hard at, putting it back, like, and this happened in revisions, was giving them vocal tics or specificity to their faces.
Mm.
I always felt like you shouldn't do that because you allow people to identify with a character more closely if their physicality is vague. But I quickly learned from my editor that that's not true. That in fact, like I've learned over and over in journalism, so I don't know why I needed to know this again. It's specificity that frees people up to identify you as opposed to vagary.
Yes, right, right. To that extent, did you have to do much because you do so much research in your day life, was there a lot of additional research to do for this, or was it really this act of imagination and character discovery as opposed to research discovery?
There was not a lot of research. The only research I did some, I downloaded some apps. I had a very weak stomach for it. It felt very bad. It felt like, okay, I'm a married woman who is not only doing this weird kind of research, even though I am in a monogamous relationship, but also, I mean, I wasn't going to meet with anyone. I just wanted to see how they talked. You know, despite what they show you in movies, there are like a lot of ethical rules that journalists follow in terms of interviewing people, and I felt very bad that there were real people that I was interacting with.
Mm-hmm.
Like I really could not bear even the ones who were being disgusting with me,
mm-hmm.
the men who were being disgusting with me. I couldn't bear that they did not understand that I was not really who I claimed to be. And it was one afternoon, and I quickly dismissed it and thought, I've seen my friends' phones. I continue to I would ask them questions if I needed to know something. But other than that, the research I did was mainly medical, because there is a medical mystery
mm-hmm.
at the center of the story.
Mm-hmm. That's funny. The Ethical Novelist. That's another book.
The Ethical Novel. I know. It was very strange for me because while I was writing this, I was still a journalist.
Right.
Like, I don't know if I'm allowed to turn it off. Well, like, hey, guys, don't worry. I was writing my novel.
Right.
I'm not sure.
That's funny. I am talking with Taffy Brodesser Ackner, and we are talking about Fleischman is in Trouble on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're drawing down on our time, but I wanted to get a couple of more cool things.
Sure.
That, you know, bookish writerly things. So you keep this Word document open on your computer 24/7.
Yeah.
And I, for some reason, I don't know, that's such a small little tidbit that seems to me so helpful, that if it's always there and every time you open up your laptop, it's, you know, a reminder, this is what I should be doing, or this is waiting for me in the background, is a good,
right.
It's a good thing. And I know you write in kind of these stolen moments.
I do. I write in moments of that I steal while I'm waiting for an edit, while I'm waiting for a train, and I write in moments of defiance when I am so frustrated either by the constraints that I've been given on a story. There's like a rebelliousness in me that says, no, today I do this, or right now I'm doing this. And sometimes it's a sentence, and sometimes it's a paragraph, and sometimes it's a page, and sometimes it's toward the end, it was it seems like I'm going to be finishing this. Can I have these 3 weekends in a row to just do this? But I'm fairly brutal on myself when it comes to this kind of stuff. But I felt like I'm never going to shut this document until it's time to send it. And that I knew, like, the way you have a to-do list, and I don't let myself check things off until, not just until, make mammogram appointment. I don't check it off until I've kept the mammogram appointment, by then I have like bodily pleasure in the check mark.
So it was write novel, so and I can't.
I'm also worried about losing it and the computer crashing and all those kinds of things. So I do email the live document to myself fairly often.
Yeah. It's impressive that it's all in one document because, you know, it's a big book and written in, you know, kind of three big parts. So just keeping all of that structure and character arc and development and all of these things straight in one document is impressive right there.
You know what? I'm a big believer in one document. I think that I'm always wary of the things that are secret procrastinations. And I know that there are people who have a separate outline, or my outline is in there too, and I start filling it out. And there is also that beautiful moment when you know you're at the end, where you make everything into one font, and you make everything the same size, and you spell check it, and you said this is a clean document that used to be a mess, and now it is a beautiful document. That said, I'm writing my second book now, which has about 5 competing storylines. And I took a gander at Scrivener.
Uh-huh.
You know of it. It's a writing software. And I thought, is this another tool of procrastination? Is this another way of going and buying fancy pens or note cards in different colors, which works for a lot of people, but for me always feels like if I do it, I'm putting off the work. I'm wary of ways that I'm tricking myself into not working under the guise of working. Like, if I'm not working, I need to know I'm not working, which means I need to be watching TV. But I downloaded Scrivener, and it looks very manageable. And I'm in a 30-day trial, and I think I'm going to buy it and just forgive myself. But I will always miss the just one big, messy Word document.
I love that. Yeah. And just the ticking reminder in the background that every minute you're not focused on it, you're not focused on it. I like that when you're not working.
Yeah.
Is there other writing advice we should have talked about that we didn't, or things that kind of got you through this? I really like the idea that the novel isn't that much different than the profiles you do, and that you feel ambivalence about the people you profile, and they're complicated and messy, and, you know, there's no one singular message about them. And that's true of characters too. I mean, these right. characters were so, it's funny because at the end of this, I read some review about how maybe they're not likable or something. And
right.
which is so who cares? But they
who
were
among
so
us is likable.
Who among us? Yes, exactly. Right. But they were written with such compassion and depth and, you know, relatability right. and all of that. That
I mean, I think that's the point. Everyone can be hated and everyone can be liked. Everyone you know is loved by someone, even if you hate them. What does that say? I mean, that's the thing. I think that the best thing to think about in terms of storytelling in any form is that everybody has a defensible point of view, meaning everybody has made their own behavior okay for themselves, and very few people are soap opera characters, stroking their goatees and talking about how they're going to take over the world. Everyone has a very good reason for their behavior. And I think the work of humanity is trying to figure out other people's reasons for their behavior.
I love it. Perfect.
True.
So true. Yeah. Taffy Brodesser Agner, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Such
this is wonderful.
A fun read. Thanks again.
Okay.
We are going to take a very short break, but I will be back in just a few moments with Kathleen Alcott. So stay tuned. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under Writers on Writing. We are on... you can follow us on Facebook as well, Writers on Writing, KUCI FM. Barbara's website is penonfire.com. Mine is mariestone.com. I'm your host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Kathleen Alcott is the author of the novels Infinite Home and The Dangers of Proximal Alphabets. Her short fiction, criticism, memoir, and food writing has appeared in outlets including Zoetrope, AllStory, The New York Times Magazine, The Guardian, The LA Review of Books, Zizova, Tin House, The Bennington Review, on and on. Her 2017 short story, Reputation Management, was shortlisted for the Sunday Times Short Story Award. A fellow of the McDowell Connolly, she has taught at Columbia University and Bennington. Her third novel is what we're talking about today, America Was Hard to Find, published this last May by Echo. We're going to chat about it and writing and process and craft, all of it this morning. Kathleen, welcome.
Hello, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Welcome on. So before we dive into the book, I'd just love to talk for a second about third novels, because we hear about first novels being kind of their own animal, and you know, you don't have as much time pressure, but you also have no roadmap. And the word on the street is that second novels are always so tricky for a variety of reasons and getting, you know, picked up and published. And so I'm wondering now with the third novel, if you feel in any way that you hit your stride or things got easier having done the other two, or if it's just, you know, the same old thing all over again where you just have to start from scratch.
I mean, I don't think that it would be accurate to say that the novels you write at a certain point in your career necessarily can prepare you for the next. I think that if you're really interested in craft, that each novel demands something different of you, right? So yeah. It probably the correct analogy has to do with endurance and stamina and exercise, right? If you're used to hiking in the desert, it might prepare you to a certain extent for hiking in the mountains, but I think that every process has to be so different if you're really interested in expanding yourself as a writer. I'm certainly not interested in writing the same book over and over again, or even writing the same kinds of sentences in every book. And so this novel was different for me in terms of what I expected of myself and what I demanded of myself. The editorial process was very different. Does that answer your question?
I love that. Yeah, I love that. And I love the analogy of the desert versus the mountains. And yes, that was it. That was perfect. So let's kind of dive in. So the book takes place in the kind of the middle-ish of the 20th century, but a lot of the themes are certainly resonant today. And, you know, particularly as we celebrated the big moon landing anniversary last week, and, you know, history is sort of writing itself, even this morning as we're sitting here, writing itself.
Yeah, happy Mueller Day,
happy
everybody.
Mueller Day, right?
For tuning in after that.
Right.
Tough act to follow.
yeah, exactly. I know. They should have scheduled this on another morning, not ours. But I'd love for you to talk just a little bit about writing kind of momentous history while your mind is existing in the momentous present, and how much you kind of, well, first of all, I'll let you kind of introduce the book and talk about that, and then kind of this idea of you know, living in the present while trying to access the past and what that was like for you. But first, why don't we set the stage for America Was Hard to Find?
You'd like me just to describe the novel?
Yeah, I think, you know, for those who haven't read it yet, I got excited and got ahead of myself for talking about it. For those who haven't yet read it, let's tell them what
sure. I mean, I sort of think that you're the person to introduce the novel, right? You've read it. It belongs to you now, but I'm happy to. You know, the seed for this novel was that about five and a half, 6 years ago when I was starting to research it, I was reading a lot about the space program, the American space program, and I was finding these very strange sort of flecks of darkness throughout a research process that was otherwise really flecked with wonder. You know, the spectacle of it was so astonishing and exciting that I kept finding these moments that would be about, you know, a group of academics who met a Goodwill tour, furious with the program, thinking it was a distraction from what America was doing to other countries, Vietnam specifically, or civil rights leaders who disapproved of the spending that went on, right, $25 billion that could have gone to poverty or civil rights, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this book kind of reimagines that line of dissent, and it also it does something that I think is semi-controversial, which is that it repositions certain central figures in history, right? The first man on the moon in this novel is not Neil Armstrong. It's a character, Vincent Kahn. Mm-hmm. And there is a domestic terrorist who is not someone that we recognize, although certainly if you're familiar with those sort of strains of fury, you have your ideas about whom I had researched. Is that a sufficient introduction for you?
That's a good one. That's a good one. I love what you said initially, because we were talking about this the last half hour, that the book is, you said something about like the book is no longer mine because, you know, it's now out there in the world and you've read it. And we were just talking about that, of the experience of what the novel is when it's in the writer's hand versus what the novel is when it's now in the world as its own independent thing, and how much the writer herself comes to learn about it digested through the eyes and conversations and whatever of others. Have you had that experience where your perception of the book has changed with it now out there in the world and the conversations that are happening as a result of it?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I read a particularly smart review by a critic named Lily Meyer, and she talked about the book being a closed experiment. She saw that the way that I had kind of tweaked the historicity of it, that I had put in people who didn't exist, was a way of calling what happened in our country in the last third of the last century inevitable. And I thought that was so interesting. I think that was probably an inchoate idea in my mind, you know, that was maybe an ink blot somewhere, but it really sharpened into a line reading that review. I think the relevant response, in Sontag's On Style, she talks about a great many things more brilliantly than I can talk about anything, but she says something like, art isn't about something, it is something.
Hmm.
And that's kind of a relief to the reader and the writer.
Mm.
To me, it's a relief because what it says is you've created something that is fixed, right? It has bevels and facets, and it's up to different people to figure out how to climb the way up that. You know, you've carved it out, but it's the roadmap for understanding it is up to those who want to interact with it. And that's kind of the best they could do. You know, if I spent my life worrying about what this book was about or what it meant to anyone who read it, I'd never write anything else.
Right. I think you mentioned this, but say it again, the sort of point of entry, what the original idea, kernel, character, plot point, whatever it was for you that hooked you into the novel at the very beginning.
It was a protest that happened, I believe, at the University of Brazil in 1969 that met the Apollo 11 Goodwill Tour.
Hmm.
And I just had never, as an American, I had never thought of the Apollo program as particularly political, right?
Hmm.
It was this strange anachronism. It felt like a wild dream that happened at the end of a wild decade. And I had never seen it as having certainly any politically divisive aspect to it.
Interesting. And so talk a little bit about going from that idea to the first draft and unpacking who these... your novels are so character-driven, and so I assume that really it was the characters that drew you into this. I don't know if that's true or not. But how you took that kernel and made the jump into writing the first draft of the book.
I'm not sure that I can even speak about the first draft anymore, you know, trying to be obtuse and opaque, but things really, really shifted since then. And also in terms of characters, are my novels character driven? Certainly. But I'd like to think that the characters are vessels for ideas more than they are, at least to me. You know, some writers talk about, like, oh, if I could have my characters to dinner, you know, this is what I would cook them. But I don't really feel that kind of compassion toward them. They're things that I watch, but they're not things that I love. But anyway, you know, what I was interested in to a centralizing extent was depersonalization, which was something that, you know, my father, who was like a pretty obnoxious leftist, was really, you know, I have this memory of being 8 years old, and, you know, he's talking to me on some long car ride. He's like, do you ever feel like your teachers are trying to strip you of your identity, you know, like with this? And I'd be like, oh, I'm not sure, Pops. You know, I kind of just want to talk about Toy Story, the film I just saw. But it's obviously something that stuck with me. You know, how do we lose our quiddity is the word, right? How do we lose the essence of ourselves in service of whichever institutions are meant to protect us or embolden us or whichever it is? And what I was realizing as I was researching on either side of the political spectrum, right, I was reading about the training routines of Apollo astronauts, and I was also reading about what the Weather Underground asked of its members. I was finding that those mechanisms weren't so vastly different. You know, Diana Otten was asked to step into the center of a circle while her comrades hurled the most brutal insults they could find, of which there were many, right? Misogynistic, mm-hmm. classist, by which I mean directed at her wealth. Diana Otten, if you don't know, was a member of the Weather Underground, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the idea behind that was that her ego would be basically eradicated, right, by that kind of abuse. And that way the radical could sort of step forward figuratively, right?
Right.
And then you had men like Neil Armstrong and Alan Bean and Wally Schirra and all the Apollo astronauts. And they were doing things like, you know, they were sitting on a chair and some scientist in a white coat was squeezing syringeful after syringeful of ice-cold water into their ear canal, right, for like 40 minutes. And the idea was, if your heart rate went up, you know, if you said anything, if you so much as gasped, like you couldn't cut it. And to gasp, right, for your heart rate to go up, if that kind of thing is happening to you, is just a sign of being a person. So on either side, the idea was, forget who you are. If you want to be someone great, then you can't be yourself. And that was really interesting to me.
Yeah, yeah, fascinating. My guest this morning is Kathleen Alcott, the book America Was Hard to Find. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. So you've talked about your memory being very image-based, and as you're talking, that's becoming clear to me that you just are very good at imagining down to the minute details. And I was kind of interested in how that manifests itself in character development and plot development. If you conjure up memories of your own, if you are drawing on, you know, kind of how you use that memory-based system in your work. Does that make sense?
Do you have a specific, like, is there an interview that you read? I'm wondering, you know, what I said that is making you.
I think it was in the Paris Review. You were talking about just drawing from these very specific images in your head, and I think it was in the Paris Review. I'd have to go back and check my notes, but
mm-hmm.
I just think that's a very helpful way for writers to, you know, if you're having trouble accessing either a scene or a character or a relationship, if you can draw from, you know, either something from memory, something from imagery, if you use photographs, if you use other sorts of imagery that,
sure.
you know, is kind
sure.
of helpful to you to stimulate this.
I couldn't possibly have accessed my own memories, at least the facts of them in terms of writing this novel, because the novel actually intentionally ends in 1988, which is the year I was born. Hmm. It starts in 1957 with the circling of Sputnik, and it ends with the Challenger disaster in 86 and its aftermath in the last 2 years. So my memories, right, don't apply. But what I can say is that because I do have that kind of memory, which deals very much in color and sound, my writing tends to happen very close to the body, is the way I put it, right? I'm really interested in sensorium, and that is the way toward any fact, is how the fact is absorbed by the body, whether that's, how a fabric feels on the fingertips, or it's the quality of light. And what I talk a lot about with my students is sensorial bias, which is like which sense needs to be the kind of driver in this scene, right? If you're dealing with a character who is clinically depressed, right, probably you're not going to let smell be the guiding sense in this scene, because smell has so much to do with the kind of like richness of feeling and hedonism, right? Like, we're aware of smell when we're fucking. We're aware of smell when we're eating like a great meal. I'm sorry, I just said a word I'm supposed to say. that's a problem with me, right? Now I'm blushing. But right, does that help? So
does,
I think
yeah.
that is a way of guiding myself through scenes that didn't happen to me, right? Is that I imagine the body experiencing this, and I imagine what the kind of heat map of sensations are, and think about where to go.
Right. It's also interesting. I mean, your writing is so very poetic, and it feels like you take. I was talking to. I can't remember now, but they were very guided by language itself, very guided by the sounds of words, the cadence of words, mm-hmm. and almost to the point where it sounded like some of that was even driving the plot itself, that the way the words were ordered together or sounds they made were almost determinative of what would happen next. And because your writing feels so very deliberate might be one word, very pleasurably sounding. I was wondering kind of the relationship between language itself and plot and character. Does that make sense?
Sure. I mean, yeah, I think I said once in an interview that I tend to catfish my sentences, by which I mean I just like humiliate them, I rob them of everything they've got. I really beat them up. In front of everybody. But by the time you see them, right, they've undergone some pretty severe revisions. I think a great deal about the sounds of sentences. You know, my students are always just like, okay, here she goes, and like the syllabic value, and like whether it's progressing or diminishing in a sentence, and what that means for kind of the emotional valence. I don't know that I could say that the plot changes because of that awareness, but I can say that it's a huge item for me in terms of unity, right? Like, I think that there are places where one should be spending their lyricism, and there are places where one shouldn't be. You know, I think a lot about, you know, Michael Ondaatje is one of my favorite writers. And he obviously writes such beautiful sentences, and he was first a poet, which a lot of people don't know. Poems are beautiful. But sometimes something happens in his books in which there are moments that get extreme lyricism that I personally feel like should be a little bit uglier, right? And so again, something I say to my students is like, so where are you spending your lyricism? Are you going to spend it like on the blowjob? Like in Michael Ondaatje, sometimes he does that. Uh-huh. And it's like, actually, here's the place where you want to pull back, where you maybe want to give your character some privacy, where you maybe want the sentences to become a little bit starker, the sounds to become a little bit more simpler, for there not to be so much assonance and consonance, right, For there not to be a nearly iambic quality to the sentences, less of a rhythm. So that's something I consider.
That's interesting. That's interesting. You were talking at some point, I think maybe in the same Paris Review interview, that I thought was really interesting, that in short stories versus novels, if you took all of the verbs in a short story and wrote them out, you could see the progression of the short story.
Mm-hmm.
Short stories are just a bit more intentional, less messy, more on the point of what the writer set out to do, as opposed to novels. And I thought that was kind of an interesting exercise that I'm going to go home and try myself. But the intention of the short story and the way you approach it versus the way you obviously approach your novels.
Yeah, well, it's a check that you can do, right? If you're revising a short story, and it's supposed to be about fear, and it's supposed to be about humiliation, you know, whatever it is. And again, I don't believe the short story, right, that art is about anything. It is something. But if you identify all the verbs and maybe even the adjectives, but because the verbs are representative of action, right, of narrative progression, if you identify those verbs and the feeling is expansive, right, if the verbs are things like hope and wish or whichever they are, even if that's surrounded by imagery that is spooky, it's not going to coalesce in the way that's necessary. But it's kind of something you can't be totally aware of as you're writing. It's a tool of revision, and revision is sort of the only gift that any of us have. I'm convinced. If you had read the first draft of this novel, you would think, what overwritten dreck this is. I mean, maybe you thought that anyways, but. It's only if we can kind of separate ourselves from our first instincts, I think, that we can produce things that are really effective. You know, there are very few instances of I really believe, like, the writer is genius who sits down and writes a perfect paragraph. If that person exists, like, I don't really want to talk to them.
Oh, we're drawing down on our time, but one last point on research, and I assume this was heavily researched regardless. I love, mm-hmm. you know, they say about writers that you have to know all the rules so that you can riff on them, and the same is true of history. You have to know all of the history so you can riff on it. And I was wondering if there were sort of things you could offer about when you knew you had done enough and when you knew you had enough out there that you could then, you know, play with it and kind of getting that proficiency and there's such an overwhelming amount of time period momentous things happening in here that feel like you could get drowned in the research and when you knew it was time to move on.
It wasn't so clean a process as you might imagine, right? Where, like, these discrete, now you're researching, now you're writing, they really were interdependent, and that just seems to make sense to me. You know, sometimes I'll feel like I have the necessary armament, and then I'll write myself into a scene and realize that there's some, there's some political fact of which I'm kind of unaware, or, you know, it might be something about, what was true of an era, and I have to return. And you know, your curiosity as a fiction writer leads you into unexpected places, so should your curiosity as a researcher. So I was reading throughout. I certainly read a great deal about the Apollo program before I had begun writing, but I had to keep returning to my research. I'm glad that I did, because if I hadn't, it would have meant that my mind didn't change about the novel as I wrote it, which I think is kind of the sign that you've written a stale novel.
Mm-hmm. Right. Good point. Did we, is there more writing advice you can share that has gotten you through, that you tell your students that you'll take with you next time that we can offer listeners?
Is there a particular aspect of writing you'd like me to offer advice on?
Oh, Lord, so much. revision is a good one, because I think a lot of people don't know when it's time to, you know, when to trust that it's time to let it go, and when you know it's still just not. I mean, I guess that's a question sometimes for your editor, but I think trusting revision and trusting when you still have a long way to go versus when it's time to give it up.
Well, I'll say a few things, some of which are general and some of which are didactic and specific. In terms of the general, I think that obviously we should all be cutting our work down quite a bit, right? Not every native thought is the necessary one. And one thing I tell students is that if you have a sentence that you love that seems autonomous and beautiful and precious to you, if it's not in some way reversing or tweaking or reconfiguring some sentence that has occurred previously on the page, if it's not addressing that, if your sentences aren't winking at each other and changing the reader's mind about the narrative, about your characters, then that sentence probably needs to go, right? There, even in a novel, there needs to be unity in that way. And unity kind of comes from dissent, from there being lots of different voices, from your sentences have different voices and responding to others. And the specific things I'll say are just that, I make sure to edit by hand. I type a first draft, and I edit my sentences by hand, and I figure out the schematics of syntax in each sentence. I count how many syllables are in each clause. I read it aloud to myself. And making those edits by hand sort of allows me to think that I'm editing someone else's work and that I have a kind of separate authority. And that, I think, is really important. Like, get off of the screen, get off of the screen as much as possible, for God's sake.
Great advice. Kathleen Alcott, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much for your interview. These were such wonderful questions.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, hold on just a moment and I'll talk to you. Hold on. That was Kathleen Alcott. The book, America Was Hard to Find. You've been listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. That's all the time we have for today. More great music coming up in just a few moments. Stay tuned for that. And we will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. Till next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.